Today we're going to be looking at Matthew chapter 14, so if you have a Bible, you can turn there. And we're going to be looking at quite a familiar passage, and many of us know it, with Jesus and Peter walking on water. And so I was trying to think, was there ever a time when I walked on water? And I'm like, well, that's kind of hard to do. But then I remembered, I'm from the north. In the north, we have cold, and we have snow, and we have ice. And so I remember I have many good memories of my days growing up in Wisconsin, where the local park had a lake, and the lake, just by nature's goodness, would freeze, and it would probably get, I don't know, at least a foot and a half deep of ice, because you could have lots of people on it, and then probably at least once a day, they would bring out a Zamboni machine. Does anyone know what a Zamboni machine is? If you watch hockey, the Zamboni machine is the machine that makes the ice smooth before and between periods of a hockey game. But they can also take these machines and then they can make the ice on a lake smooth. And so a Zamboni machine probably weighs over 1,000 pounds. So you can imagine how much weight ice can handle if it is thick enough. And it's nothing like ice skating on smooth lake ice. It's a fun experience. So yes, you can tell everyone that your pastor walks on water or walked on water. But, you know, it's a little different than what we're going to look at today. And the theme of what we're looking at today, really, I mean, Andrew's been saying prayer, and prayer definitely feeds into this because as we approach the Lord in prayer, we are doing so by faith, and we want to live by faith. And we'll explore that as we look at our passage of Jesus and the disciples on the lake. So let's read this together, our passage, beginning in verse 22. So let's begin. Immediately Jesus made the disciples get into the boat and go ahead of him to the other side, while he dismissed the crowd. After he dismissed them, he went up on a mountainside by himself to pray. Later that night he was alone, and the boat was already a considerable distance from land, buffeted by the waves because the wind was against it. Shortly before dawn, Jesus went out to them, walking on the lake. When the disciples saw him walking on the lake, they were terrified. "It's a ghost," they said, and cried out in fear. But Jesus immediately said to them, "Take courage, it is I, don't be afraid." "Lord, if it's you," Peter replied, "tell me to come to you on the water." "Come," he said. Then Peter got down out of the boat, walked on the water, and came toward Jesus. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid, and beginning to sink, cried out, "Lord, save me." Immediately Jesus reached out his hand and caught him. "You of little faith," he said, "why did you doubt?" And when they climbed into the boat, the wind died down, and those who were in the boat worshipped him, saying, "Truly, you are the Son of God." And so the first thing we see here, actually, is this expression, getting away. Many people in the summer in the U.S., Grace's parents live in New Zealand, so in November, December, January, in the Southern Hemisphere, it's holiday, it's vacation, it's time to get away, time to leave the comfort of home and maybe go on vacation or go to the lake or do fun things outside when the weather is going well. And some people really need, I think we all need this time to get away. There's actually a condition in Japan called, I don't know if I'm pronouncing this right, karoshi. And karoshi, I don't know if you've heard of this, but it's called death by overwork. When I typed in, I didn't know what it was called, so I said like Japanese sudden death. And then I printed it out, and then I did images, and then there was images of all these businessmen who were like collapsed in train stations and on subways, and basically it's mostly businessmen, and they're coming to or from work or on the trains or whatever, and they collapse and die, and that's called karoshi. And it's basically what it said. It's because of overwork. Now, I'm not exactly sure the physiology behind it, whether the heart gets stressed and there's a heart attack or exactly what is all into it. But many of these men, I'm sure it could be some women, are working 80, 90, 100 hours a week, and they just never stop. And at some point, their body just gives out and they die. So working hard is good. Overworking karoshi, bad. In this passage here, the context that we see is this is a depiction of John the Baptist. John the Baptist was imprisoned by King Herod, and Jesus had found out just prior to our passage that we read that John the Baptist was beheaded. And so if you kind of remember the story, Herod had a party, and then his stepdaughter or daughter or something did a dance, and then it pleased him so much he said, "You can have anything," and she asked for John the Baptist's head on a platter, and so he was martyred then by Herod. And Jesus heard about what happened, and it says, this is following the whole story of the beheading of John the Baptist, when Jesus heard what had happened, he withdrew by boat privately to a solitary place. Hearing of this, the crowds followed him on foot from the towns. When Jesus landed and saw a large crowd, he had compassion on them and healed their sick. And so I think Jesus, when he hears about the man, it was his cousin, boy that he grew up with, someone who he would have been close to, and found out that he is now dead, I think this probably would have been, as you can imagine, an emotionally difficult time for Jesus. And so he wanted to get away and be with his thoughts and pray. But even in trying to do this, I don't think the crowds knew the circumstances, but they knew that Jesus had withdrawn to this lonely place. And so somehow people probably saw him, and the crowds just began to continue to seek to press upon Jesus. And he saw them, and in spite of his need to get away and to emotionally recharge, nonetheless, he had compassion on them, and he continued his ministry of healing. So this is what sets us up. And also the other passage, the other event that took place immediately after this. So we have the beheading of John the Baptist, Jesus going to a solitary place, continued healing. As he's continuing to heal others, there's this great crowd. It's getting to be towards dusk, and the disciples said, "Well, send everybody home. They need to go and get food, and they needed a place to stay." And that's when Jesus and the disciples said, "Well, Jesus said, "You feed them." And Jesus said, "Well, the disciples said, "We only have 5 loaves and 2 fishes." And then Jesus proceeded to pray and feed 5,000 people, not including women and children. And so this was the next miracle. And it said the number of those who ate was about 5,000 men, besides women and children. Immediately Jesus made the disciples get into the boat and go ahead of them to the other side. When he dismissed the crowd, after he dismissed them, he went up on a mountainside by himself to pray. Later that night, he was there alone. And so you can see Jesus was in a place that he was extremely busy, but he had found out emotionally troubling news, and I think he also was physically tired from the ministry that he was doing, and he was probably spiritually depleted because of the healing that was taking place through his ministry. And so Jesus again went to find a lonely place. He went to find a place to basically recharge his batteries and to pray and to rest. Now there's an article that was in Harvard Business Review by Tony Schwartz. He also has a website called The Energy Project. And in his article, he talked about the need. In this case, he's a consultant to companies and to workers, and he's saying that one of the more important things to have productivity for workers is to manage our energy properly. But I don't think it's just for business people, it's for any of us, and I think it has relevance as well to those of us who are seeking to follow Jesus. We need to manage our energy, and Tony Schwartz says there's four energy tanks. And so if you think of a gas tank, when you fill up with gas, eventually it depletes and soon it gets close to empty. And then if you don't go to the gas station and fill it back up, it'll fully deplete and the car will cease running. Unfortunately, that happened to me once or twice in my many years. But you want to keep the gas tank filled. You want to keep these different tanks in our lives filled. And these are physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual. And I think we see this, as I had mentioned, in the life of Jesus right here. We acknowledge Jesus as theologically as being fully God and also fully man. And in his humanity, Jesus would have experienced his tanks depleting on a number of levels, and even like we see in the passage, and like I mentioned, Jesus physically, I think, was most likely depleted for having gone a whole day, maybe many days, preaching and healing. Emotionally, I think he was depleted because of the news of John the Baptist. But even just the fact of doing a lot of ministry and spending a lot of time with people, I think, can be emotionally draining. Mentally draining, I don't know if Jesus was mentally drained in this particular case, but many of you who are students, many of you who work on projects and the like through your jobs that you have to use your mind a lot, you know it can be mentally draining when you use your mind. And then spiritually, of course. And I think we can be depleted spiritually. We can be dry. And the key is to try to keep our tanks filled. There was a pastor, Bill Hybels. He's pastor of Willow Creek Church, which is in Illinois. It's one of the first, what we would call a mega church, began in the 1980s. And I heard a seminar by him, and he basically talked about these different tanks, and I don't think he had the mental tank, but he talked about physical, emotional, spiritual. And he was saying that at one point in the previous year or two from when he gave the lecture at my seminary, that he was feeling burned out. And it was a big church, so you could kind of understand there's a lot of demands on him. But he said the strange thing for him was that he really felt that spiritually he was doing well, and that he was taking time to be with the Lord and to be in the Word and to pray and to have accountability. And so, like, that tank he thought was full. And then he thought then physically, you know, he said, I was getting enough rest, and he worked out regularly and tried to stay in shape and whatever. And so he thought physically he was okay, but nonetheless he was still experiencing burnout. And what he realized, what it was actually the emotional part of his life that was depleted. And I think partly that had to do with relationships that he was in, not only maybe at home with his family, but also his church. But he also said that what he realized is that when he, say, preached, and he was in a bigger church, so maybe on a Sunday he had to preach at three or four different services. And he said that that just really wiped him out emotionally. And so after he would get home and he would spend an evening with the family at night on Sunday night, he would come back to work, to church that Monday morning, and then he would begin with meetings and ministry for the next week. And what he found was that really wasn't enough time for him to recover emotionally from his weekend of ministry. And so I think he had to rearrange his schedule and maybe take Monday. Many of us pastors take Monday off. So then he began to take Monday off, and that gave him enough time then to recover, maybe physically and emotionally. All of, I mean, we're not being, you know, as humans, we're not people that we can easily distinguish between these different tanks. Everything is kind of interrelated. But nonetheless, I think Jesus had a recognition that he had to get away sometimes. He had to take care of himself and reconnect with God and reconnect even physically and emotionally. So it's a good lesson I think we can learn from Jesus. The second thing that we see here is taking a walk. And what did Peter do? Well, he took a walk. He sent the disciples, his disciples, on so Jesus could then go to the mountainside. And he said the boat was already a considerable distance from land. It was buffeted by the waves because the wind was against it. And shortly before dawn, Jesus went out to them walking on the lake. And then it says that they were terrified. They thought that it was a ghost and they were afraid. But then he calmed them, saying that it was him. And this event took place on the Sea of Galilee. The Sea of Galilee is in the northern part of Israel, north of Samaria. We see to the left anyway on the map is Nazareth. That would have been the place where Jesus basically grew up, Jesus of Nazareth, though he was born in the south in Bethlehem. He grew up in Nazareth. It says in some other passages, actually, parallel passages to this, that he sent the boat away, the boat with the disciples to Capernaum. And Capernaum was actually the place where Jesus lived as an adult and where it would have been his hometown as an adult. And we see him coming and going often from Capernaum. And so since they were being sent to the other side of the lake, we can only assume that they were somewhere on the southern shores, maybe in Kinneret or Carrick. And then these fishermen, these experienced seafaring people, then made their way to the northern part of the lake, which is Capernaum. And then it was where Jesus, after receiving sufficient recharging of his batteries, made his way on the lake, I guess the only way he could, unless he found a boat, but I guess it was more expedient for him to just walk on water. And some people actually have questioned whether this is a real miracle of Jesus. You can go to YouTube. You type like walk on water illusion, things like that, and there's actually magicians out there who have replicated walking on water. And I think I saw a documentary once. So some people say, well, no, Jesus couldn't have done that. It's an illusion. And then others have explained it that Jesus had some hoverboard device. Well, of course, they didn't have hoverboards 2,000 years ago. But they thought, well, he made up some piece of wood. And maybe, I don't even know if they had bicycles that long ago. So I think it's a difficult thing to explain that Jesus created this small boat that he walked on. But in any case, the scriptures say that Jesus walked on water. He didn't float on water. And when you look at these illusions, usually they're in fairly shallow lakes or pools, and because they have to, there's tricks to these illusions. But Jesus was in a sea, the Sea of Galilee. There's no way that he could have set things up in a way to make this magic trick work. And nonetheless, even if he did, it said that there were storms and the boat was buffeted by waves. So in any case, the skeptics in trying to denounce Jesus's miracles, I think you can really come only to one conclusion, that the most reasonable explanation is the explanation we find in Scripture, in that it was a miracle. Jesus actually walked on water. Any other plausible explanations really are implausible. So skeptics are skeptical, but nonetheless, we see, and I think it's reasonable that we can believe that Jesus actually did walk on water. And to me, this really points to the fact that Jesus is worthy. When I was reading through this, the thing that kind of struck just for myself is when I was reading the passage, I tend to, when I read this passage, I tend to focus or think of Peter walking on water, that Peter took this step of faith and began to walk on water. But actually, what really struck me this time was that it was Jesus who walked on water. It was Jesus who did the miracle. And in the context of this passage, he didn't only do this miracle, but Jesus spent time healing people of illnesses and blindness and things that just were not healable back in that day. And Jesus fed 5,000, and after the 5 loaves and 2 fishes, he blessed them. I forget how many baskets you can look, 10 baskets, 11 baskets they had left over. And so this was another miracle. And so we see Jesus continuously doing miracles. And this points to, I think, his divinity. So now we see Jesus' humanity, but we see also his divinity, at least God working through him. And to me, it points to the fact that he is worthy, that Jesus isn't just a miracle worker, but he is one who is part of the Godhead and is able to do the will of the Father and to do these things that are just not possible by any other human being. And so I think this can and maybe should hopefully lead to a posture of worship. And we'll see that being played out even later on in this passage. And the next thing that we see then as we continue our passage is follow the leader. Now, I don't know if you ever, I think this is a kids game, follow the leader. You have a bunch of children usually, but I guess adults can do it. And there's a leader and you follow them and they do silly things and arm gestures and movements and everyone has to follow the leader. And if you don't follow the leader, then you're out of the game. So follow the leader is actually what Peter was doing, because that's what disciples do. It said, Jesus immediately came, said to them, "Take courage, don't be afraid." And then Peter says, "Lord, if it's you, tell me to come to you on the water." And Jesus said, "Come." And so Peter gets out of the boat, walked on water, and came to Jesus. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid. Beginning to sink, he cried out, "Lord, save me." Immediately Jesus reached out his hand and caught him. "You have little faith," he said. "Why did you doubt?" And so we see here that Peter was actually being a good disciple. A disciple is one who follows a leader. And Jesus was a rabbi and he had disciples. And Jesus wasn't the only rabbi. There were many rabbis in that day who had followers. But nonetheless, Jesus was the rabbi, the teacher, and the disciples were called to follow him. And so it sounds crazy that seeing someone on the lake that you would actually, I can just imagine the thoughts or expressions of the other disciples when they're on the boat with Jesus and Peter is saying, "Oh, let me walk with you, let me go out with you on the water." And I'm sure his friends were thinking, Peter is doing something crazy here because you just can't walk on water. But Jesus was walking on water, Peter is a good disciple of Jesus, and so Peter, I think, decides he wants to walk on water too. And so he then has this exchange with Jesus. "If it's you, call me to you." And Jesus says, "Come." And then he begins to walk on water. And I think this is a challenge to us. And I think we could really spend a lot of time unpacking just this narrative with Peter. Peter was a disciple. He followed Jesus, but he took a risk. He didn't have to do this. He could have been content being with the rest of the disciples, waiting for Jesus to come in the boat and then calm the storm. And even trusting in Jesus to do that, I think, is significant. But nonetheless, Peter decided that he wanted to take the risk and he wanted to get out of the boat. Now, of course, he did that and he begins to walk towards Jesus. And we see by the story, he begins to, what does it say? He saw the wind and was afraid and began to sink, cried out, "Lord, save me." And so Peter began to take his eyes off Jesus. He began to look at the waves. He began to look at the wind. He began to look at the circumstances that were surrounding him. And through that, he began to lose his faith. And so, of course, I think one of the lessons is to keep our eyes on Jesus even through the storms and difficulties of our lives. But even in spite of the fact that Peter, in a sense, failed because he lost faith and began to sink, and he cried out, and Jesus saved him. And Jesus even rebuked him a little bit. We see immediately, "You have little faith," he said, "why did you doubt?" So Jesus rebuked him at least a little bit. But I actually give Peter a lot of credit here, because the other disciples weren't even willing to try. And he was willing to try. He was willing to get out of the boat and to take this leap of faith. And this reminded me of a church that every year, like our church now, we've been having appreciation dinners. And so the church had an appreciation dinner. And the pastor that I was talking to said that what one of the awards that they gave out every year was to someone who sought to do a ministry in the church, tried to do something new, but failed. Okay? You get a nice trophy for the best failure. You don't quite think of that as being trophy-minded, but the pastor said that they wanted to have an award like that because they wanted to encourage people to take steps of faith. They wanted to encourage them to take risks. And I don't necessarily know what some of these things may have been. You know, maybe someone decided they wanted to have a homeless outreach or something, but, you know, maybe they lived in the suburbs and it was wealthy and there wasn't that many homeless. And, you know, I don't know, like ministries can fail for a lot of number of reasons. And it's not necessarily because it didn't lack preparation or diligence on the part of one or a team that's working on it. So ministries fail for different reasons. But nonetheless, I really like that, though, like to reward people for taking the risk. And I think because of that, that particular church was able to foster a value of risk taking and encouraging people to try things that they might not normally try, and to, of course, the church would try to support them, the pastors would try to support them in those things. But even if you fail, that's okay. And I think for all of us, we need encouragement maybe in different areas to get out of the boat, to take steps of faith. And for every one of us, that can mean something different at different times in our lives and due to different circumstances. For some of you, maybe you've recently began school, and so that is a step of faith. For others of us, we're deciding to, we may have decisions that we're trying to make, and maybe we're trying to figure out all of the different pros and cons, and that's definitely good, and that's what I do. But maybe God's prompting us to, even if it doesn't seem to make sense, to still take that step. So nonetheless, I think it's something that we can all be encouraged to at times, to get out of the boat and to take those steps of faith. And so then what is the response? Well, I think we've already begun to talk about different ways we can respond to this passage. And I think the main theme of it, as we've been seeing, is to live by faith and to seek the Lord by faith, not by sight. And I also think, going back to the beginning of the passage, that maybe some of us need a reminder to take care of ourselves. Maybe we're burning the there's an American expression to burn the candle on both ends. And so if you think of a two-prong candle, and if it's burning on both ends, well, at some point it's going to come to the end and just flitter out. So we all need to take care of ourselves, and we all need to, in different areas, maybe for you it might be spiritually, maybe you need to spend more time in the Word and prayer, or in Bible study, or for some of you, you may need emotional healing, or maybe you need physical healing, or maybe physical, getting more sleep, or taking a Sabbath. Sabbath is created by God, not for man, but man was created for the Sabbath. We all need rest, however we try to get that. But we also see a response, and it's the response that the disciples had in the boat. And when they climbed into the boat, and they would have been Peter and Jesus, the wind died down, and those who were in the boat worshipped him, Jesus, saying, "Truly you are the Son of God." And so we see the response then of the disciples, who were being buffeted by the winds and waves. Then they get freaked out seeing what they think is a ghost, but it's actually Jesus. And then when he comes in the boat, the waves calm, and their response is to worship God and to acknowledge that truly you are the Son of God. And I think that's a response that we can all have. As we seek to live by faith, maybe we can also think about having an attitude and posture of worship. Worship isn't just something that we do on Sunday, but I think hopefully it is something that we can live out during the week, not only in our times with God, but even when we're driving on the road or we're walking down the street or whatever we're doing, hopefully we can have an attitude of worship, because we know that our God is worthy. We know that our God is great, and that He wants us to take those steps of faith. And when we do, He's there to pick us up and to help us recover like He did for Peter. And so let's be encouraged today. You might think, I don't have a lot of faith, and when I look at my own life, I'm not sure if I have a lot of faith either, but Jesus and the Lord wants us to take faith-filled risks, and He wants us to live by faith, not by sight. So let's pray. Heavenly Father, we do thank You for this passage and for this challenge that we have, that even Jesus had need, and He needed to take time with You. And of course, we know that we all have such need in our humanity. But also, Lord, You desire that we live by faith, that we walk by faith, not by sight. And help us, Lord, to reach out to You and to take steps of faith and to respond as the disciples did with a cry, a heart cry of worship to You. So we thank You in Jesus' name. Amen.